This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Lou Olkowski, host of Love Me, a podcast about the messiness of human connection. We've got a brand new season coming your way this summer that will punch you right in the heart. A secret diary takes over a young woman's identity, and a toothless chihuahua saves her owner's life. Subscribe at cbc.ca/loveme or wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's interesting because this was the heart of the neighborhood. And when you build a neighborhood, what do you need?
I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas.
You need a synagogue, you need a school, and you need a business area. So this is the synagogue. The school was right here.
Mass migration has reached the highest rate in history, and tensions keep escalating over who really belongs anywhere.
Now, in Israel, we have about 45,000 African asylum seekers, the vast majority are from Eritrea, and the rest are from Sudan. And what do we do with these people?
That's why we've produced a special 5-part series featuring speakers from countries with their own complex and sometimes troubled history with the other. We're calling this series Us and Them, Diversity, Division, and a World of Difference.
We cannot deport them because the UN claims that there is danger for their life, so we give them the group protection, which doesn't let them work. So what do we do with them?
What you're going to see now is predominantly non-Jewish migrants here. And a lot of people blame them for the deterioration of this area, but that's absolutely not true historically. It started way before.
I'm walking through an immigrant neighborhood in South Tel Aviv with a brilliant anthropologist named Galia Sabar. She specializes in migration issues generally and immigration to Israel in particular.
Okay, the people that you see here are all Eritreans and Sudanese. They work. Most of them work. They have no choice. They have to survive. I mean, they are here. And now there is...
Galia is president of Israel's Rupin Academic Center, which is about a half hour's drive north of Tel Aviv.
Jewish tradition in its core has mechanisms of living with disagreements. So why today we're trying to find one voice? Why can't there be a plural way of celebrating, for me, my Judaism, but you know, for others as well, for the Muslims, the Christians, and that is something that we have to scream out loud. You know, look at the Holy Book, at the Bible, and see how many voices were, and to see the different people, the 12 tribes of Israel.
So this is one synagogue, and we've got Iraqi synagogues and East European, Ukrainian synagogues and Sephardic synagogues, all within a tiny perimeter. So the divisions amongst the Jews is not something that started today. You know, two Jews, three synagogues. So that's how it goes.
You'll be hearing more of my tour with Galia Sabar throughout this episode. But we'll start with her lecture, which she called, What Tribe Are You From?
I was born and raised in Israel in a very liberal house. Both my parents are academics. So from a very young age, I was privileged to travel around the world with them. And I was exposed to different cultures, to different people, smells, habits, rituals. And I always considered myself an Israeli, a practicing Reform Jew. I knew that my great-grandparents and grandparents came from Eastern Europe, mainly from Russia, from Poland, from Lithuania. They came prior and post-World War II out of true Zionism in an aspiration to build the home of the Jewish people. My parents were already born in Israel. And I must admit that I, as a youngster, did not spend time on thinking about who I am, to which category do I belong, or where do I fit. Things were very clear to me. However, when I was an undergrad student at Tel Aviv University. I was doing African studies, anthropology, and I flew to Kenya in the early 80s. And every time I met a Kenyan, a young and an old, men, women, they asked me three questions. What's your name? Does your name have a meaning, or who do you belong to? And the other question was, which tribe are you from? So obviously, I said my name is Galia, and I'm named after my grandfather, whose name was Gedalia. And I laughed, and I said, we don't have tribes. And they said, uh-uh, that's not possible. Each person belongs to a tribe. And I insisted, and I said, no, there are no tribes in Israel. We're one big tribe, Israelis. They insisted, and I insisted. I must say that for me back then, using the word tribe was not relevant. It was something one would use speaking about traditional society or saying primitive people, they have tribes. We, in the modern world, don't have tribes. Well, little did I know. Indeed, within the Israeli discourse for many, many years, both the political, the public, the academic, it was more common to stress the fact that we are all Jewish migrants who came from all over the world to Israel. And here, through a mechanism that was named the melting pot, we were all supposed to become an Israeli. There was like this prototype that we all had to fit into it. All of us Jews, obviously. And the common features of the Jews were highlighted, and the differences were commonly silenced. Now, obviously, we have to say that this was part of a much larger project of nation building, creating a very strong us. A strong us, and then you have to have the them. So our us was vis-a-vis usually the Arabs, or the Jews against the Muslims, the Israelis against the Palestinians, because the whole discourse should be seen as part of a much larger reality that had to do with a national and a territorial struggle. I think that for many, many years, we did not have the privilege, or so we said, to truly look into ourselves. But was this melting pot mechanism truly working? And this is the large question. And out of this large question, I believe that there are two main sub-questions that really come up. Are we truly a tribeless society? And is plurality and diversity something negative or bad or something problematic? Now, as mentioned before, for many years, the dominant public discourse in Israel was about, as I said, unity, about us. Sometimes, following Benedict Anderson, it was definitely an invented us, highlighting the common denominators. But reality was knocking at our door. Realities were claiming to be heard and analyzed and discussed and studied and recognized. I must say that I think that it was only in mid or late 2015 that our president, Reuven Rivlin, spoke about the new Israeli tribes. Not the 12 biblical tribes that everybody likes to speak about, but he was speaking in terms of tribalism, like we were studying in anthropology about those societies and not us. I believe he was the first prominent Israeli leader that spoke in terms of tribalism when he was analyzing Israeli society, when he was trying to portray the realities of the 21st century of Israel. His voice was loud and clear. He spoke about diversities and fragmentations and obstacles, divisions, but he also offered ways to deal with diversities, to take it and turn it into a positive force. and I'll come back to it. So when President Rivlin spoke about tribes in Israel, he had four main tribes. The first were the secular Jews, the Orthodox Jews, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, the Haredim, and the Arabs. Now, when he really spoke about these four tribes, he clearly said that all those who came here were migrants from different places and different ways or modalities of living. But we have to look at these four tribes and realize that his tribal map was actually based on the existing divisions within the educational system in Israel. In other words, each of these four tribes has its own educational system. So the interesting thing about Reuven Rivlin's speech was that it opened a debate, a loud and clear, and at times very violent and impatient debate about tribes. Many, many people joined in this debate and offered different tribal divisions. For example, new migrants versus old or veteran migrants, Ashkenazi Jews or Mizrahim Jews, or others spoke about race, blacks against whites, or based on ethnicity or on class, those who have and those who have not. Others spoke about the X, Y, and Z generation and all the rest. Yes, and speaking about that as the main tribal division in Israel. Now, obviously, all these divisions are relevant, and all of them have a basis in our very, very complex Israeli reality. However, for our discussion today, I would like to go back for a minute to President Rivlin's four tribes, group them into two tribes, and add an additional tribe. So the first tribe would be the Jews, and then the Arabs, and then I would like to suggest that the third tribe are the non-Jewish migrants, the labor migrants, and the asylum seekers and refugees.
The first ones to come were from Darfur in South Sudan, while the civil war in South Sudan and the genocide in Darfur. And about 1,000 of them, the first ones, did get some sort of temporary legal status in the country. But once the waves continued and the numbers increased, the government was terrified of a tsunami of and that's a term that the government used, of asylum seekers. And that's when they adopted this group protection visa, which is, it's neither this nor that.
Are these people, is this still a place where people come to get temporary work for one day
yeah.
only?
Yeah.
So an employer will come here and say,
and
I
fetch
need
them.
Three diggers.
Right. Painters, construction, lifting heavy things, you know, cleaning, or yeah.
But, hard labor.
But most of them are employed on a regular basis. It means that the market needs them. The economy needs these workers.
And the longest they can stay, though, is 5 years?
No, because these have the group protection. You cannot deport them. The government doesn't deport them, but makes their life so miserable that they will ask to leave. So out of 60,000 that were here in 2013, we now have about 40,000. So 20,000 were either luckily relocated in other countries or pushed out of Israel in various ways.
When we look at numbers, and numbers here are important, the figure which is constantly quoted about the population of Israel is around 8 million people. But what does it comprise in the official documents? 6.5 million Jews, about 1.5 million Arabs, and that's it. And nobody speaks about the 250,000 of others who live here. And these are significantly important for our discussion. Now, when we look at these categories, the first two, the Arabs and the Jews, are the tribes that most people know, that everybody speaks about. Israel is usually portrayed in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian discourse and the divisions within the Jewish world and the subdivisions within the Muslims and all that. But I would like here to say more about this new tribe that I offer. As of 2017, there are about 250,000 non-Jewish migrants in Israel. Some are registered as international labor migrants holding work visas and permits. Some are tourists who just forgot to leave the country after their visas were expired. And others, about 60,000, are African asylum seekers or refugees, mainly from Eritrea and Sudan. Now, we have to say it very clear. Up until the early 1990s, there were no international labor migrants in Israel, because since 1967, those who came to work to Israel were mainly Palestinians, and they would come in the morning and leave at night. So they were not considered as international migrant workers. But once the first Palestinian uprising erupted in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the closure on the West Bank and Gaza created a shortage in labor. And the first option that the Israeli government has adopted, and I have to open brackets, without really looking at the experience of other countries in the West, was to import international labor migrants. The first came for construction and agriculture. But slowly but surely and gradually the numbers grew up, and from a few thousand by the beginning of the 1990s, by 1996, there were about 200,000 international labor migrants in Israel. Some of them, obviously, once their visa expired, opted to go back home. But others opted to remain in Israel. And that was something that the Israeli government didn't even consider could happen, that the people that they were bringing were subjects, were not objects. And these subjects have their own will, and they fall in love, and they get married, and they have children, and their children go to our schools and use our medical systems. And suddenly, we had all these others that were no longer separated from us, but they were within us, mainly in Tel Aviv, but not only, around Eilat, the southern city, and Arad, and other places. And these families, the kids grew up, and around the beginning of 2000, there was a huge struggle led by migrant workers and human rights activists for the rights of those children that were born and raised in Israel. And according to the Israeli laws, these children were not entitled to Israeli citizenship. But following this battle, several hundred children and their immediate families did get Israeli citizenship. And these children grew up, and when they came to the age of 18, they joined the Israeli Defense Forces, which is the ultimate way of proving your Israeliness. Around that time of the struggle in 2005, a new phenomena was challenging Israel. And these are the refugees or the asylum seekers. The first African asylum seekers crossing the lax border between Israel and Egypt came in 2006, and there were several thousand of them. But gradually the numbers grew up until 2011, that almost 18,000 African asylum seekers entered Israel. And the total in 2016 was about 60,000. And this was a huge challenge to the state of Israel. We were not prepared for that. Since the establishment of the state of Israel in 1948, less than few hundred people asked asylum in Israel. There were the famous cases of the Vietnamese or the boat people that our late President Menachem Begin opened the door and accepted them. And there were some unaccompanied teenagers that came following the war in Yugoslavia from Serbia and Bosnia that did get a refugee status, but that's it. We did not, or we were not challenged with really dealing with who is a refugee And what is our own policy vis-a-vis non-Jewish migrants who are claiming to be asylum seekers?
I'm Paul Kennedy, and you're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and CBC.ca. This is the second part of a special five-part series called Us and Them, Diversity, Division, and a World of Difference, which we produced in partnership with the Laurier Institution in Vancouver. Our featured speaker is Galia Sabar.
And I'm the president of Rupin Academic Center. I've been doing African studies for many, many years, and my research has focused on African migration, including labor migrants, refugees and asylum seekers. And I've been living both in Israel and in various African countries for many, many years.
Just before her lecture, I sat down with Galia to find out more about her passion for what she's calling Israel's newest tribe, the migrant underclass. It turns out that the government of Israel, which, as you've heard, she's not shy about criticizing, approached her back in 1982 when she was still an undergraduate with an offer that changed the course of her life.
I was offered to go as a guide, taking North American and Canadian Jews who supported financially and politically the clandestine operation to rescue Ethiopian Jews and support them on their journey from Ethiopia via Sudan to Israel. It was then not known so much around the world. Later, it was known as Operation Moses, with thousands of Ethiopian Jews, men, women, children, really went via that way. So in order to have the Canadians, Americans see where the money goes and you know, really show the support to the people that they were funding the operation, we took them there because through these tours we were able to pass on both information and funds to the Jews in Ethiopia for them to pay off their way to Sudan. So between 1982 and 1984, I went in and out Ethiopia dozens of times, sometimes with Canadians and Americans and sometimes just like preparing. You know, you have to remember these were the days of the very, very dark, oppressive regime of Mengistu Haile Mariam, who overthrew Emperor Haile Selassie. And it was a horrific regime, extremely brutal, very intrusive into people's lives. And obviously, nobody was allowed to leave the country without a permit. And actually, the Jews were escaping Ethiopia. So it was really dangerous both being there, either as a Jew and a local, a Canadian, an American. It was, you know, it wasn't a tour, you know, in the regular way. It was really a mission to do that. And then in 1984, the cover was exposed and we were no longer allowed to go in. And actually, Operation Moses stopped because, you know, for the Jews to have a safe place in Sudan, there was this agreement with the president of Sudan at the time, Jafar Numeri. He got paid by Canadians, Americans, and the Israeli government for allowing the Jews. Now, once it was exposed, the Arab countries threatened him, so he had to stop it. So all the Jews in Sudan had to be evacuated really quickly. And then that route really stopped existing. And it took years and years for the Ethiopian Jews who got stuck in Ethiopia to be able to come to Israel. It took some of them over a decade. So it was a very difficult time because part of their family was already in Israel. Another part was en route somewhere. Another part was still waiting. So when, you know, when we look about this whole thing, it started way in the late 1970s to try and rescue these Jews. And it's actually an ongoing process. Even as we're speaking today, they are descendant of these first Ethiopian Jews who are still coming to Israel.
The people that you see here are all Eritreans and Sudanese.
And they would have come within the last decade or the last 5 years?
Yeah, since 2006. That's when Sudanese and Eritreans started to come in. And these are the people that I was speaking about, that they have this group protection visa that protects them from deportation but doesn't give them any other rights. They work. Most of them work. Usually they're exploited on the one hand. On the other hand, they don't pay tax, so they're not registered. So everything is like black market or, you know, the parallel economy. They have no choice. They have to survive. I mean, it's such a stupidity. I mean, on the side of the government, the migration authorities, they are here. And now there is a fence, so no new asylum seekers are coming into Israel since 2013.
How do the asylum seekers hear about Israel?
That's an excellent question, because the situation in Eritrea and Sudan was terrible even before 2006. So you have to ask yourself the question, why then? So, you know, in sociology of migration, you always have the push and pull factors. So the push factors are very clear. It's the terrible situation in those countries. But also in December 2005, there were these very, very severe riots in Cairo. And the Egyptian police shot the demonstrators that were mainly refugees or asylum seekers from Sudan, Libya, Eritrea. And a lot of them started just to flee, you know, first in a trickle, then in a flood towards Israel. Now, this route via the Sinai Desert is not a new route. There were armor smugglings. There were trafficking in mainly in women for the prostitution industry. So the Bedouin who live in the Sinai Desert were really experts in, you know, this smuggling. So in the past, it was arms. That was the cargo, okay? And then it was these poor women from Ukraine that were bought and sold into the prostitution. And then the cargo changed to asylum seekers and refugees. And it's horrific to speak about it in these terms, but it's human cargo. So for the Bedouin, it was just swapping one merchandise and, with another one. And, you know, covering it with human rights discourse, and these are people who are escaping, which they truly are, but obviously there are so many people that exploit it.
You're a commodity, really.
Oh yeah, it is. It's a human commodity, absolutely.
The time Gallia spent in Operation Moses, helping Jews get out of Ethiopia and into Israel, put her on the trajectory that has defined her entire career.
I can't stay aloof from the subjects of my research. You know, they're living people and lively cultures and interesting issues. So once they were here, I was very much engaged, like a social activist, in the absorption and in their struggles against racism, and they had to prove their Judaism, and they went through a very, very painful process vis-a-vis the Orthodox here in Israel, the white Orthodox, that it was very difficult for them to accept the idea that they were Jews because they were blacks, because they practiced a different Judaism than what was common here in Israel. And these struggles are not over yet. That's part of the complexities of Israeli society. So yes, I was very privileged, and I'm still, you know, even now as a president of Rupin Academic Center, we've got a whole support system that helps them remember and know about their past and be proud of who they are, who their parents, or where their parents came from, and integrate within Israeli society without losing their Ethiopian black identity, which isn't an easy task.
Look at this shop, okay? What you will see here is everything that a migrant needs. He needs a place to stay, he needs transportation, he needs food that comes from home, he needs communication. So you will see a lot of cellular shops that sell and fix. You will see places to eat, restaurants and food shops. And you will also see things that have to do with your own culture, with your home culture. So you can really try and feel at home within the diaspora or the exile. So this is a wonderful example, because this also shows that they have the means to to buy these things. Okay, they are expensive. They come from Eritrea or Ethiopia. They bring it addressed like this. The embroidered one can cost several hundred dollars. So we have to have a much broader way that we think of asylum seekers and refugees. It forces us to look at a much more complex way at their lives. It's not just a survival or a base.
They're desperately seeking normalcy.
And a kind of stability and clearness regarding their future. You know, if you know, like in Canada, that you have X years of being in one status and then you have a chance of going. But here the process is extremely unclear and the policies are changing all the time and it creates a lot of anxiety for the people.
Anxiety Galia is talking about is something I glimpsed firsthand. While she was taking me around the migrant neighborhood in Tel Aviv, on the tour you've been hearing throughout this episode, videographer James Cooper began shooting examples of street life and the exteriors of storefronts. One shopkeeper approached us in obvious agitation and demanded that we turn off the camera and destroy the tape. He wasn't actually threatening us. It was more a case of him feeling insecure. But then something else happened. Another man, who ran a small kitchen restaurant, recognized Galia. As you can likely tell, she's a very warm and gracious person. This man saw her from a distance, hurried up to where we were, and the two exchanged enthusiastic greetings and spontaneous hugs. We stepped inside the man's tiny shop and back to his kitchen, which was no bigger than a closet. We watched as he stirred bubbling pots of various dishes, with Galia actually lending a hand in the cooking. It goes without saying that he insisted we sample his cuisine, and I've got to confess that if I'd closed my eyes, I could have imagined myself in Darfur. Each mouthful was flavored with memories and love. Within a matter of moments, we had experienced two seemingly irreconcilable stories. The first expressed the anxieties felt by what Galia calls the new tribe of Israel, the migrant class, the asylum seekers with nowhere else to go. And the second story was much happier and more hopeful. It pointed towards a paradigm of hospitality and openness that, for Galia, speaks directly to Israel's founding principles.
Israel was founded as a safe haven for Jews. At the time, there was like a prototype of who's a Jew, okay? And although there were Jews from Yemen and Jews from Morocco, it was fairly predominantly white Jew. And Ethiopian Jews and Indian Jews, or Jews coming from the subcontinent of India, challenged that prototype or that acceptance of who's a Jew. That was one thing. The other was what kind of Judaism were they practicing? And the specific or the uniqueness of Ethiopian Jews was very difficult for the rest of the Jewish world. They had at least one specific holiday, the Sigd, which nobody else has. They do not recognize all the books, the holy books that the other Jews, they have other holy books of their own beyond the Torah. So I think that the hardest clash is between Ethiopian Jews and the rest up until today.
Which is not something the world at large knows about. I mean, people around the world think of Israel as a country in which if there are issues, the issues are between Palestinians and Israelis or Arabs and Jews. But this is another issue altogether that is not well known.
Yeah, well, sometimes I say that it's good that is not out there. You know, we've got enough issues, and this is something that we really have to struggle amongst ourselves and come to terms with it. But you're right. You know, most of the discourse around the world about Israel is framed within the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or Jewish-Muslim conflict, and less about the inner diversities of the Jewish-Israeli society. But it's there. It's absolutely there, and it has to do with color, with race, has to do with a different kind of Judaism. It has to do with these are people who came from Africa, and how do you enable Ethiopian Jews, North African Jews celebrate their own identity and feel at home within the larger Israeli arena.
As someone who's practically worked on the ground to solve this issue as a political issue or as an issue of migration, and then on the other hand, you must have to convince other people who have the same skin color as you do in Israel that this is an issue that has to be dealt with as well. So I mean, you're sort of pulled in two directions as well.
There's another direction that I'm pulled. You know, I'm white. I'm a privileged woman with education, with means to do these struggles. And some of Ethiopian Jews would not accept my position. Yeah, because who are you to speak on our behalf? And I try not to do that, you know, and not to patronize. And I'm really happy to pull out in many ways, because the more you have young Ethiopian men and women that speak for themselves, that know how to use, you know, the political arena, the media, all kinds of media, then they don't need me, which is wonderful.
When you throw that all together, it could get either very confusing or fascinatingly interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and you haven't mentioned gender.
Okay.
And generational differences. Oh, yes. I think that the Ethiopian issue, and also, you know, all those that were left behind or marginalized by the Israeli institution or the Israeli governments and are now claiming their place, their position, their rights to be acknowledged, to be heard, to be respected. I'm with them. Yeah, absolutely.
Are you hopeful?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that you can be, at least not in my research area, which is African studies, without having hope. That's one thing. And also you can't be an Israeli and a Zionist Israeli without hope. I mean, you wouldn't be here if you thought that forever and ever we'll have to struggle for our survival. That it just, you can't. You have to have hope.
When you look at the names of the streets, you can imagine what they wanted. This is called Mount Zion Street. Okay, what can be more biblical, full of hope, than the Mount of Zion? And when you look around, you say, whoa. In this building, inside of it, there are five different churches. Okay, mainly African churches, but also Philippine churches. You know, we are in the heart of Jewish Tel Aviv. And when I started my research on West African migrants in 1996, the first thing I realized that within this very small area, we had about 40 or 50 African independent churches, evangelical ones, independent African churches, and nobody knew about it. They rented these spaces, and people would come here to pray on Friday evening, Saturday, and Sunday. And it was a very, very lively community. So what you see from the outside is just the facade. Okay, and inside there's a whole additional dimension of people's lives. And they were smart enough not to put up big signs and crosses to, you know, annoy other people.
Right.
And so, you know, it was completely disguised. When I grew up, I lived in a very different neighborhood in Tel Aviv, but we used to come here because here was a central bus station. So we used to come here when we traveled. We used to take the buses, and as soldiers, we usually coming here. And it was a street where you could buy cheap shoes, you know, cheap things. It was the main street that we would go through. I mean, everybody knew what's Neve Sha'anan. And then in the early 80s, the mayor of Tel Aviv decided to uplift this neighborhood, and it turned this main street into a pedestrian area. And it just happened that it correlated with the influx of migrants. So all these programs from the 80s to raise the level of the infrastructure and everything just never happened. Now you would see a lot of Eritrean and Sudanese restaurants. Okay? Now you would say, why would they go out to eat? Because the apartments that they live in are so small and crowded, so they go out to eat in very cheap places. Here you can really see the tower that you see in the middle with Hebrew letters on it, it's called the Shalom Meir Tower. This is, was the first high-rise in Israel, and it was like the most expensive and modern commercial building, and that really was the heart of the rich and the wealthy Tel Aviv. And look, it's just here. When you look at it, it's just amazing. I mean, you can read about it, and that's a source of a lot of tension for many, many years between South Tel Aviv and Central and North Tel Aviv. So this was almost from the beginning the backyard of Tel Aviv, and it's just now that they have someone new to blame, you know, the new victim to blame for all the bad conditions here.
It seems to be a universal trend. The latest arrivals anywhere and everywhere in the world tend to attract much, if not most, of the criticism for what's going wrong in any given country. Galia Sabar began her career helping Ethiopian Jews make the dangerous and desperate exodus to Israel. That was back in 1982. She spent the intervening years studying and finding ways to incorporate migrants, especially asylum seekers, into Israeli life. That, above all, has been her professional and personal calling, as you'll hear in this, the concluding part of her public talk. What tribe do you come from?
Now, in Israel, we have about 45,000 African asylum seekers, the vast majority are from Eritrea, and the rest are from Sudan. And what do we do with these people? We cannot deport them because the UN claims that there is danger for their lives. So we give them the group protection, which doesn't let them work. So what do we do with them? They're here. They're having children. They live here. They're human beings. How does the state of Israel deal with this third tribe, which are non-Jewish and non-citizens, but they are here? They're part of our society. Their kids go to kindergarten, and then they grow up, and they're part and parcel of our society. So the answer to the first question, does Israel have tribes, or Israel is a tribeless society, then I think that by now you realize that obviously we do have tribes within our society. So I would like to turn to the second question. Is plurality and diversity necessary problematic? Is this something that has to be broken or changed or overcome as if it is a type of cancer, a disease? What do we do with diversities and divisions in order to turn them into a positive engine of growth and development? And there are lots of models, and there are lots of modalities, and I don't think there is one correct one or true one. But I do believe that diversity and pluralism is a natural reality to any human society. That is a truth that we have to recognize. And the second idea is that diversity is indeed or can be a source of strength. Pluralism and diversity are the basis for development, for improvement, for innovation. However, in order to have that, I believe that we have to provide four main pillars or tools or mechanism of operation. And the first one is based on knowledge. We have to learn, first of all, about our own story, about our own narratives, about our own unique cultural identities. And then we have to learn about the others. The other's histories, the other narratives, the other cultural practices. We just celebrated Passover. In my family, there is one tradition, and the seventh day was never a big celebration. Once my brother was married to a Moroccan Jew, suddenly the seventh day of Passover became the Mimuna celebration. And this has now become a recognized day, which was never when I grew up. People that didn't, or kids that didn't come from Moroccan families did not know it. Or the Sigd of the Ethiopian Jews, that it's the only Jewish community that celebrate that specific holiday. So we have to enable us, our kids, to learn about our own family history or tribal history, but also the others, because knowledge has the potential to reduce fear. The second pillar is respect of the otherness. We are different, but we're different and equal in the true meaning of the sense of equality. The third pillar, which I think is the most crucial one, is to create spaces to celebrate your separate identity, but also spaces to celebrate integration and mutual identities. And these are important, and those are important, and they have to have legitimacy to do this and that. A few days ago, we celebrated Israel's 69th Independence Day. For the vast majority of the citizens of Israel, this was a day of joy. But for others that are part and parcel of this country, this was a day of mourning. For them, that was the beginning of their tragedy. I don't have to agree, I have to learn about it. I have to respect their separate narrative and enable them to have their spaces to celebrate and to learn about their narrative. And the last pillar is to agree to cohabitate, agree to disagree. Agree to disagree within clear legal and moral boundaries. President Rivlin, as I said, spoke about four tribes, and he offered three main arenas where we can cope with this diversity and pluralism. He identified the educational arena, the workplace, and sports. He framed his national program under the title Israeli Hope. Indeed, the three major arenas do bear the potential to offer these four pillars that I've just laid out. Here, I come to our unique microcosmos, Rupin Academic Center. Because Rupin is, in many ways, a microcosmos of Israeli society. A body of student and faculty is comprised of secular Jews and religious Jews and ultra-Orthodox Jews and Ashkenazi and Sephardim and students of Ethiopian descent and Arab Muslim and Christian Muslims. And we do diversity, and we are diversity by being here. But we not only come from different places, but we truly and proactively relate to our differences. We don't try to blur them, we don't ignore them, but we truly promote multicultural sensitivity. We speak about diversity and cultural competency, and we do that also through social engagement. One of the interesting institutions that we have here is the Institute for Immigration and Social Integration. It's the only research institute in Israel that looks at Jewish and non-Jewish migration. Now, I know I'm a very optimistic person, and to do African studies for over 25 years, you have to be optimistic. To live in Israel and choose to live here, you have to be optimistic. And yet, we still have a long way to go. I'm not naive. It's an ongoing process, but we have to speak about it. We have to acknowledge the issues. Just before I come to the end of my talk, I want to go back to the story I started with, the question, which tribe are you from? And even today, when I travel around the African continent and I'm asked this question, I still have difficulties in answering, and I still give the same answer. I'm an Israeli, and there is apparently a large Israeli tribe, but a large tribe that has divisions, that should respect more the diversity and the plurality and the differences of narratives, of histories, and cultures. But this is the base of our Israeli society. Thank you.
Galia had given us plenty to think about when it comes to the idea of diversity. After listening to Galia's political analysis, after learning how it emerged from her real-life experience, but most of all after walking around the streets of southern Tel Aviv with her, I felt an unfamiliar and unexpected impulse towards optimism. It was that optimistic impulse that prompted me to ask her one last question.
What, in the topic of diversity, the topic of all, many of the complexities you talked about, what does Israel have to teach the world?
Wow. I think that there may be three main issues that I think are unique. First, it's the history of the Jewish people. I think that our ancient history, but mainly our recent history, teaches us or has to teach us a lesson of compassion and caring and empathy to others. And it's World War II and the Holocaust and the way that we were persecuted because we were the ultimate other that has to be exterminated. So we, out of all people around the world, have to be, on the one hand, strong and know how to protect our own rights, but at the same time, be sensitive to those others. So that is the first thing. The second thing is that within our cultures, there is a very strong inclination to study. And study and science, it's all about diversity, asking questions, accepting different modalities of thought and responses. So how can we shut down, diverse voices? That is our strength. Absolutely true for the scientific world. I mean, if you have in a research group, people that they all think alike, nothing will come out of their research. You have to have this diversity. That's the raison d'être, of the academic world. And we are people of the book, of learning. And I think that the third thing is that regarding diversity, I think our Jewish tradition in its core has mechanisms of living with disagreements. So why today we're trying to find one voice? Why can't there be a plural way of celebrating, for me, my Judaism, but for others as well, for the Muslims, the Christians, and that is something that we have to scream out loud. Look at the Holy Book, at the Bible, and see how many voices were, and to see the different people, the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay, so that is something that it's a gift that we have, and we have to practice it first within ourselves, and then we can export that idea.
Been listening to Galia Sabar and to a public lecture she gave at the Rupin Academic Center, of which she's the president. Her talk was called What Tribe Are You From? It's the second part of a special 5-hour international series called Us and Them: Diversity, Division, and a World of Difference. The series is produced in partnership with the Laurier Institution, and special thanks to the Canadian Embassy in Israel. This episode was produced by Lisa Godfrey and Greg Kelly. There's a video of the tour that Galia took me on through the migrant neighborhoods of Tel Aviv. It's on our website, cbc.ca/ideas, where you can always get our podcast. You can also live stream all our programs on the Radio Player Canada app. Music for Us and Them was composed by Virginia Kilbertus. Audio and video production, James Cooper. Additional technical production, Dave Field. Liz Nagy is our associate producer, and the executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.